Good afternoon, good evening, good morning, ladies and gentlemen, wherever you are in the world. This is Jock, this is Deadly Departed, and I am absolutely delighted to have my guest with me today. It's been a long time since I've had a guest. It's actually been a long time since we've done a really in-depth episode. And my guest today is Steve Parsons. And if you do not know who Steve is, then you do not know nothing about the paranormal world or the world of parapsychology, because this man is the seed of controversy, if you like, in the parapsychology field. And if really you're interested in this side of things, then this is who you want to listen to. We're going to dive straight into it. And we're talking about a number of things today, but in particular, for all you guys out there that run paranormal teams or mediums that believe in orb phenomena, we're going to find out, is orb phenomena true? Is it a farce? Or is it just a figment of your imagination from your digital camera?
Welcome to Deadly Departed. The do's, don'ts, and dangers of afterlife communication. This show discusses all aspects of afterlife communication, grief and grieving, the paranormal, and of course, parapsychology. There's real stories, scientific discussion, and most of all, real learning from paranormal experts and researchers. Here's your host, author of Deadly Departed, renowned evidential medium and spirit interventionist, Jock Brocas.
So, Steve, welcome to Deadly Departed, my friend. How are you?
I'm very well. It's nice and warm here in the UK, thank goodness.
Yeah, you've got some good weather over there. Actually, my wife said to me the other day, they're getting better weather over in Swansea than we are here.
Yeah, not complaining. It'll be raining tomorrow. Probably.
I woke up this. You could get four seasons in one day, Steve.
We can and we do. In fact, we did yesterday. Started off cold and grey and misty. And then by the end of the day, we had rain. We missed out the snow. I don't think we had winter yesterday. But then we were up to 23 by the late afternoon. That's Celsius for Americans.
So listen, we are people listen to us all over the world. There's going to be a lot of people, Steve, that don't actually know how you are. And I'm surprised if they're interested in the paranormal, they don't know you, then they don't know anything.
I'm not. Job broker, professional oil
broker. If you're serious about it, then you know him. So tell us a little bit about your background, Steve, in the paranormal, parapsychology, how you managed to get into this field, what your interests were.
It kind of started off as a kid, because I just wanted to see a ghost. I'd read some of the, it's as simple as that. I got a copy of Guinness Book of World Records for Christmas one year, and in it said the most haunted house in England, a little picture of Borley Rectory. And I found, because this is in the days before the internet, we had to go to libraries and get books out. And I got some books out by Harry Price.
I remember them days.
A long time ago.
Oh, yes, yeah.
I got some books by Harry Price and Andrew Green and Elliot O'Donnell and started to read about these ghost hunters. And, they would sit on the stairs in the dead of night, armed with nothing but, their God-given senses, occasionally a blunderbuss. And the white lady would drift down the corridor, or the headless, figure would glide silently up the staircase. I thought, that sounds so cool. I want to see a ghost. So from about age 5 or 6, we had some broken-down buildings that looked like your archetype. There was a farm, there was a windmill, there were some others nearby. And so I used to take myself off. And this was by day because I was only 6 or 7, to look for the ghost. I wanted to see a ghost. And that's how it started. And gradually the realization that it wasn't quite as straightforward as that. And, it's not like you see on television now where you just turn up for a few hours and there are demons and ghosts and poltergeists and all manner of stuff appearing to order. I had to wait a long time before I encountered my first spook. And so gradually, you know, I love technology, you know, who doesn't? And for my 13th birthday, I got a cassette recorder, which I used to start taking with me, and a little Kodak disc camera. And gradually, you know, the idea of if I'm going to see a ghost, then I'm going to give myself the maximum chance, maximum opportunities, you know, study the phenomena, be in the right place at the right time. And the equipment was there just to, for me, you know, to prove to myself that I wasn't imagining it. And, you know, the years went on and the desire still there. I still want to see a ghost. But it's
so you haven't actually seen one yet.
Oh yeah, yeah. I was lucky in the end. But it's become more a realization that actually what you're studying is not the paranormal phenomena, but it's why people have these experiences. You know, people say, "Well, do you believe in ghosts?" I said, "Well, I believe people see ghosts, and they, you know, they report these experiences." So it's kind of like grown into, well, I want to know why. You know, I accept the reality of the experience, but now I want to understand why some people do, some people don't, why I had to wait so many years. And other people, you know, look at Zach Bagans. Every time he walks into a building.
Oh, he always sees it. Don't even, let's not even go there.
I even tried wearing a brush mask, shouting dude, but it didn't make any difference.
So, I mean, you've become quite an expert in the field, and you've studied parapsychology for many years. In fact, I mean, you've appeared on national, international media, TV shows, Most Haunted. And one thing I like about your work and is that you really have a good scientific ground in things. You don't just accept anything. So, you know, why do you think then some people are more... I mean, because obviously we have bias. There's people that are biased to paranormal phenomena. If you believe in it, you're going to see it, which will bring us a nice segue onto this whole orb phenomena. But, you know, where do you see the problem in bias, especially in experiences out there?
Certainly in the case of investigation, people go into, I mean, a lot of people go on, and they're very popular, you know, organized investigations. I think, well, let's just rewind a little bit. Let's go to Most Haunted and the TV explosion that happened around 2002, 2001 here in the UK, which then, you know, then you had TAPS and Ghost Hunters in America that followed it. And it, I think it showed, because ghosts have always been a popular genre. You know, they've always sold copy papers. They've always sold books. You know, some of the big name ghost hunters like Harry Price or... stop it. Emails arriving. Harry Price and Elliot O'Donnell.
Don't think it recorded, Steve. It's all right.
They, you know, they sold, you know, they were big selling authors because the subject is popular. Mm. But it was before 2000, it was kind of like, I'd love to go ghost hunting. But people didn't know how to. They didn't, you know, it wasn't something... It was something that they liked the idea of. And then the TV show showed them that ordinary people, you know, the makeup lady, the cameraman, the rigs could in fact, you know, so people started to form their own groups. And the other thing that was fairly unique about Most Haunted was because they needed something to happen. You know, because let's face it, you know, sitting on a set of stairs in the middle of the night can be dull.
Pretty boring.
And so they brought along Derek Acora. And he could go, he's a bad Nivy. He's over there, Nivy. Because, I mean, it was an entertaining television program. But it gave people the realization that they could go ghost hunting. But the boggle factor, you know, the sort of the benchmark for having an experience is very low in a lot of people because they're going back in the 50s, 60s, 70s. If you wanted a spooky night out, you went to the movies, you watched The Exorcist or Poltergeist and you had the crap scared out of you. Now when people started going ghost hunting, it was kind of an interactive scary movie that they were part of and that they could control. Yeah. And to give it some semblance of credibility, they called it investigating. They, you know, they took gadgets with them that they'd seen people using on television. Mm. But what you do find is the expectation levels are high, and the benchmark for having an experience is very low. So it's like, if you can hear my voice, can you make something happen? It doesn't matter what the next noise is going to be. They will go, thank you, can you do it again? And then you know, another noise. Oh, thank you, can you do it again? You know, if I was the ghost, I'd be like, I've done it three bloody times. What do you want? my favorite one is, well, the two favorites you always hear, don't you? You always hear, we mean you no harm. They're dead, for Christ's sake. You know, what's the worst thing? We'll bring them back. Or use our energy.
Yeah.
What's that mean? You know, it's like, so when something happens, it's confirmation bias. They get what they're looking for. They get the bejesus scared out of them. They hear, you know, whatever it is they want to hear. It's similar to a EVP phenomena. You know, they take these.
Yeah, that's another. Yeah, doesn't matter another what, show what we'll do.
Yeah.
I think that's one for a round table there, Steve. Yeah.
Guaranteed.
So let me jump on this, because you've had a lot of experience with the TV and people, and obviously with their bias and things. And one of the reasons that you and I kind of got together is you wrote a paper for Paranthropology. Were great, which is a great periodical, and I loved it. I loved that you actually wrote about how orbs, how you can actually prove definitively that orbs are not true. And I want to kind of jump into this as we are talking about most haunted and everything else, because I remember, and certainly for in my work in afterlife research and mediumship, you know, I got a little bit hated because I kind of went, well, you know. The reality is that the orbs are not real phenomena, and unless there's real intelligence behind them and there is a pattern to that intelligence and interaction, then you can't actually say it. You know, it would warrant further investigation, and at the moment you can't say what it is because there's no definitive evidence. But you do have in your paper pretty much a lot of definitive evidence that it is not true, and I want to jump into that. So.
Well, I'm going to start off with the most haunted.
Yeah, go for that.
Well, I'm going to start off with the most haunted funny story, because I was on the couch for one of the lives and they were all out in the field and they captured orbs. And they said, let's go back to the studio and ask our expert. So it's like, okay, so you're on the couch. What do you think is, you know, what's your take on it? I went, I hope death's final. And the presenter looked at me and said, huh? I said, I'm a fairly intelligent, sentient bloke.
Yeah.
And if you tell me that after I die, I come back as a stone throwing soap bubble, forget it. I don't want that.
That's going to be a clip, you know, ladies and gentlemen. I love that.
As a soap bubble throwing small pebbles at people. But what happened was, in the late 1990s, we bought our first digital camera. It was a Sony Mavica. Mm. I think it had the resolution, I think it was about nearly half a megapixel resolution. And we were using it primarily, we were building these using floor planning software. And making 3D models of locations we were investigating.
Yeah.
And we would add to the models photographs taken from the viewpoints of people who claimed, you know, something had happened. So we could check that, you know, could you actually see that from where you were claimed to, you know, where you were sitting or standing or walking. So that's what the camera was there for. And also it was a good way of recording, you know, cheaply locations. But what we started to notice is these little blob, these little circular blobs were appearing on the pictures. And we were like, what are these? These are unusual. We're not, you know, we don't expect them. What can they be? And we christened them light balls just because that's what we, you know, just these little balls of light. But there, I mean, there was no, they were two dimensional, circular. We should call them light discs or something, but, you know, we call them light balls. Around about the same time, there was an American team who were also using a digital camera. And this was in the days of bulletin boards. And they, I think they were christened, they christened them orbs. And we fell in line with that description as well. And we were getting them fairly often in locations that we were investigating. And we got to the point where they were becoming so common. And this is what worried us. We were getting them with depressing regularity. So we reached a conclusion based on that, that hang on, this is too common. We're getting them too often. So either the digital camera is the world's greatest ghost hunting gadget, or we're dealing with something entirely normal here. And we did some experimentation and we did some playing around, and we reached the conclusion that what we were dealing with was airborne particles, water droplets and such like. And we were fairly confident with that, but we couldn't definitively prove that to be the case until we had an experiment that we'd wanted to do for the longest time using two cameras again to use stereo photography. And stereo photography has been around in the paranormal, you know, community since the 1920s. You know, Harry Price had 3D cameras. But we could never come up with a system whereby both, you know, we could never make the two shots absolutely identical because you're dealing with two different cameras.
Yeah.
Then about Fuji brought out a camera, the W3, and it was actually one digital camera that had two sensors, two lenses. So it was effectively everything was identical. They were matched across the systems, and later a Panasonic brought out a version of it as well. This is when 3D was all the rage. Yeah. But it, for the first time, it allowed us to, we saw this camera promoted. We said, we've got to have one of them. I wrote to Fuji, wasn't imported into the UK at the time, but we begged and pleaded and we got one imported early from Japan.
Wow.
And we started, what we decided upon was a series of experiments to use it in exactly the same way that all of the people capturing orbs on their images would do. So we just took it along in full auto mode and used it as a point, you know, as a point and shoot camera, exactly the same as every other digital camera that was being used. And the idea being, of course, if the orb was an external phenomena close, you know, a distance from the camera, then the parallax would demonstrate that it would be in the same place on two side-by-side stereo images. If as we suspected, what we were dealing with was a very small out-of-focus dust particle or water droplet, very close, so within 2 or 3 centimeters of the camera lens itself, then it would appear differently on the two stereo images. And we took over 12,000 stereo pairs, so 24,000 wow. individual pictures. And we went through them meticulously, you know, marking on where these discs were, these blobs of light were. And about the same time, of course, the camera manufacturers themselves had said, you know, there are many of the digital cameras contain a warning about these blobs of light when you use your flash or exactly that reason. But the digital camera, the three-dimensional camera, gave us the ability to definitively prove that this was a phenomena It wasn't at the far end of the room. It wasn't lurking behind a post. It was within 1 to 3 centimeters of the front element of the lens itself. So now we published that along with the earlier experiments where we had, you know, we were testing other ideas, you know, to prove it was water droplets and airborne dust. Which is the paper you read? And the response was, I had an email within about 3 days of publication from a nice gentleman who said, "Fascinating paper. I fully agree with everything you say. But are you aware that in picture number 23 in the submission that was, because there was a load of pictures included in the electronic version of the paper, there is a face," which just proves that you can never, ever, ever shake anybody's ability. Now, what we've always made clear,
I always put that down to pareidolia, though, Steve.
No, it was a real face.
It was a real face. It was
a joke.
I would say, yeah, you're just pulling my leg now.
I forgot what I was going to say then. That's gone.
No, he got in touch. He said there was a real face in the number 2620.
He was convinced he'd seen the face. But what I've always made clear is we were testing the phenomena of the orb as an artifact of digital photography. And the reason it appears on digital cameras is because digital cameras are very small, very compact. The lens and the distance between the lens and the flash element is very small, so you get a far higher potential for bounce back. So it bounces, you know, the light flashes off the camera, hits the dust, and comes straight back down the lens aperture. So, you know, you don't get this with DSLRs where the flash is mounted atop the camera where you increase that distance, or it's much rarer. You get it a lot on infrared night vision, of course, because on night vision CCTV cameras or video cameras, the infrared LEDs are not often located around the lens or almost coaxial with the lens. So you get a very high return, reflection return rate. But we always made the point that that's what we were looking at. The experiment was only ever to test the idea of whether the digital camera was capturing something paranormal or something normal. And we always emphasized that for hundreds of years, long predating photography in any form, there were reports of balls of light. Over here in Wales, we have the Corpse Candle, Canoli Corff. And you have Willow the Wisp and jack-o'-lanterns. Now, they may be similar, but they're a completely different phenomena. So to say that, you know, the paper was dismissing all light phenomena, all, you know, these balls of lights like corpse candles and jack-o'-lanterns, will-o'-the-wisps, is erroneous, because we were dealing with their appearance on small form digital cameras.
Why do you think, Steve, that in the, I don't want to say a new age community, but spiritual community, even in mediums community, mediumship, afterlife research, that they have basically attached themselves to the reality of these orbs being spirit phenomena. Now, I understand, you know, I've witnessed light phenomena, but this is ridiculous half the time.
I mean, it is pure belief. They want to have something definitive to show for their efforts, to show, you know, and there have been, you know, there are innumerable books, Ascension Through Orbs and, you know, others that have been written about how they've looked at orbs and analyzed orbs and considered, you know, the different color orbs represent different energetic beings or, you know, angelic beings it's all, in my opinion, it's all desire. It's not make-believe. Right. It's deeper than that, because to a lot of people, to a lot of mediums and investigators, you are, when you explain to them the process is a perfectly well understood physical process, physical phenomena, you are dealing with somebody, it's almost like you're dealing with somebody's religious beliefs. These are very deep set beliefs, you know. And if people genuinely, you know, believe that, I think it was Noel Edmonds, the BBC television personality, who notably said in the national media that he firmly believed that his deceased parents were returning as these little blobs of light on photographs taken with his digital camera. And he was getting a degree of comfort from that.
Well, yeah, because it's a very thin line. It can cause some trauma, I think, as well.
Yeah. And, you know, you've got to be mindful of the ethics of, you know, just dismissing somebody's experiences or beliefs and simply saying, no, you're talking rubbish. It's because the camera is doing this. Mm. Because on many of the, you know, we used to do a show on BBC radio show, and you would have people phoning up, and they would explain their experience. Now, without going into any details, some of these experiences were entirely explainable very quickly. You know, but when they're describing their experience, you go, yeah, I know exactly what the cause of that is. But they were deriving a great deal of comfort from the fact that the deceased mother, brother, relative, whatever, close friend, was returning to them and giving this visible demonstration of survival. Now, we would never ever dream of saying, "Oh, that's just rubbish." You know, it's. You know, we just simply say, "Well, I'm really pleased you're getting some comfort from that, and long may it continue." Because as Dr. Cal Cooper is, you know, been considering, is the self-counseling of the bereaved by, you know, getting comfort from knowing that, you know, we survive bodily death.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, there is an ethical side to it. So in terms of orbs, if people want to believe, I am going to do nothing but offer, you know, here is an explanation. This has been tested. It is definitive. It withstood scrutiny.
Yes.
It withstood peer review. It is repeatable. I can create orbs to order on camera.
Now, what about, let me stop you a minute. What about I mean, you know as well as I do, that there are mediums out there that claim that they can create orbs to order without even any. How would you explain that away? Because they swear blind, and I'm not taking anything away from them. Perhaps that's true. For me, it needs to have a lot more evidence for me to accept it. But a lot of people claim, you know, especially mediums, they can create orbs just through their intention.
Well, their evidence is usually, and when I've been in that position, their evidence is usually in the form of a photograph taken at some location, somebody's home or a haunted location. And if you take along a digital camera, small form factor digital camera, and you take a random group of 10 photographs, you will find that there are these discs of light on probably 7 or 8 of them, because the air is intrinsically dirty. It is full of, you only have to look at the way the sun streams through, sunlight streams through a window to see all the suspended dust particles in the atmosphere. We were at Hammond Castle in Massachusetts, and we had the camera with us. We had the digital camera with us, the 3D camera with us. And Ron, my friend and co-host on Ghost Chronicles, was I had him stand in the middle of the room and raise an arm up, you know, sort of as if he was grasping something. And I took, I think, 8 or 9 photographs. And on 3 of them, there is an orb in just, you know, close enough for you to say, well, it's connected.
He's holding it.
It wasn't. It was entirely, you know, random. But if you take 10 photographs, you will probably find some were buried in on a computer drive. Some were is the actual analysis of how common this phenomena was. In the early experiments, we downloaded more than 20. We took a random selection of 25,000 images downloaded from bulletin boards and internet sites, of which, you know, we were just looking for pictures that contain these blobs of light, these discs of light. Mm. The vast majority of them never made any mention of them, but they were still there nonetheless, because these were taken on, these were holiday snaps. There was even a few naughty bedroom snaps with orbs in them. Because we were, you know, wherever people were putting digital photographs, we were, you know, collecting them up to look for orbs. And we found they were fantastically common. You know, it was a very high percentage of small form factor digital photography that was containing these. And we broke it down by camera manufacturer and type.
You could actually tell the difference in the camera manufacturers by the
No. What we could do is we could say if you know, your Canon PowerShot 300 was more likely than a, because it was a physically smaller camera, the way the flash was positioned to the lens. And we could tell the maker and model, because a lot of people back then didn't, you know, label the photography. They didn't say, like, you know, granny at the beach. It was just the basic file, IMG dot, you know, and each manufacturer has a slightly different way of labeling. And then you also have the EXIF data, which gives you, you know, information about the type of camera, the shutter speed, where the flash was fired. So, you know, if you had a small pocketable point-and-shoot camera, you were very likely to get orbs. Now, interestingly, the ratio of orbs has now dropped. They're a lot rarer now than they were in the early 2000s, because we've all switched over to this type of camera.
Yeah.
And because the software in these very rarely uses the accessory light, which is a soft LED light that's, and it uses HDR photography rather than using the accessory light. So the number of orbs is actually decreasing in digital photography, because we're now using the smartphones rather than the little pocket point and shoot digital cameras of 15 years ago, you know, the 4 megapixel power shots and wherever else you were.
I want to go jump back to this, the whole idea of people believing, or people who have lost loved ones believing in orbs, and obviously we don't want to upset them. But do you also think that there's a, you know, that maybe there's more of a danger in them putting their whole faith and trust in an orb phenomena for comfort, especially if you're dealing with someone who's perhaps, you know, going into the realms of prolonged grief disorder or some kind of even borderline psychosis? Because I would get that they're not always going to get these orbs. Now, I know I do a lot of grief counseling. I run a grief community, I run a grief group, and I always try to educate in the right way and say, look, you know, should you think that that's an orb, then we're looking for extra phenomena. We're looking for a pattern. We're looking for evidence. We're looking for this, that, the next thing. Because I've also witnessed, Steve, that people then that, you know, believe in it and put their faith in it and they get comfort from it, there's going to come a time where that's not as readily available. That it stops. Like they change their phone, they've not got this thing. And then they're borderline, they're really going into experiencing more trauma and more grief because they're not getting it back.
I mean, that's part of being human. Some people will cling on to ideas that give them comfort for longer than is They don't go through the grieving process. They don't complete the grieving process because there are several, you know, there are multiple stages of the grieving process. And I think to be, to come through the grieving process, you have to pass through all of the stages. But we all know, and you know, in my nursing career, I met many people who never, for whatever reason, completed the grieving process. And I think the takeaway from that is if people are locked into the grieving process and becoming over reliant on going to mediums or photography or whatever it is that's giving them comfort to the point where it becomes they can't function without that input any longer, then that's where you need grief counseling, you need psychological intervention.
Absolutely.
You need to help them move forward with their lives. And it would be disingenuous and unethical to allow them to, you know, in nursing, we used to say, in psychiatry, we used to say, never feed the delusion.
I get that.
And that there comes a point where you have to break that cycle. And in a way, the paper offering them, you know, have a read of this, here is a different perspective, is, you know, I can't go any further. You know, I don't have, and, you know, but I've referred people to bereavement counseling. I've referred people to psychological help.
Yeah.
Because I have my areas of expertise and I don't pretend to stray into areas where I have no expertise. That would be unethical and immoral of me. You know, I'm not a psychologist. I'm a physicist and an engineer, and I have medical qualifications. I don't have qualifications in bereavement counseling or psychology. But I know people that have, and I know when, you know, and I think all investigators should be that responsible. But what you see is investigators who, you know, one minute they're a scientist with, you know, a gadget, and the next minute they're offering to perform an exorcism. And then the next minute they're offering, you know, a whole range
every,
of, you
and,
know.
And I find that every investigator is a medium as well, for God, for, you know, most of them are. Especially out here in America,
well,
they're paranormal investigators, they're mediums, they're experts in technology and everything else.
I find one of the most disturbing for me is the move from, because it did, you know, the same here in the UK. You have these pseudo-scientific mediums who they know all the lines, and they always say, "Well, you know, as a skeptical medium, you know, I'm." But then they've moved into exorcism and clearance and areas that, you know, you have to wonder what on earth they're doing apart from, you know, self-aggrandizement. You know, their ego, they're massaging their own egos, you know, with these quasi-religious rituals and clearances. And you know, I've encountered it many times in the real world, not just in the media, where you know, some well-meaning, and they you know, the mediums usually are well-meaning. They're normally you know, they believe in themselves because they've probably deluded themselves. That sprinkling salt, you know, around a place and waving, you know, various herbs and spices after setting fire to them, smudging and all sorts of other things. I mean, yeah, if you want to sprinkle salt around, it's great.
In my book, Deadly Departed, I do talk about exorcisms and things like that from a historical point of view. But I do make very clear that woo-woo sticks are not going to get away if there is any potential. And scientifically verified, it's not going to happen.
There are parapsychologists who advocate exorcism as being a helpful recourse in some situations. In some poltergeist cases, for example, exorcism has proved helpful. But the experts in exorcism are the churches. Yeah. They are not some bloke you know, who lives around the corner, who's got himself a dog collar, some, you know, herbs and spices, and starts flinging stuff around in your house and chanting in gibberish Latin.
Yes,
you know, I've heard an exorcist actually say in the name of the holy book and the Necronomicon. Now, I didn't realize Lovecraft had written, you know, such significant book in the Necronomicon. You know, they might as well have said in the name of Harry Potter. You see on television now, you see this sort of mumbo jumbo.
Yeah.
You know, sort of pseudo-acting being uttered. There is a lot of it. And, I'm not telling people, you know, if they believe in it and it gives them comfort and they're a responsible adult and they want to employ this person to burn garden herbs and sprinkle salt around. If that gives them comfort and satisfaction, then so be it. You know, there is the placebo effect after all. But empirically, it doesn't work unless you have an infestation of slugs. And then sprinkling salt around is incredibly effective.
We'll get rid of them. I'm a big believer anyway that there's no tools out there going to do it. And at the end of the day, if there was a serious problem, then it's only ever going to come down to prayer and spiritual, you know, awareness at the end of the day anyway.
You know, I've been in cases where people say, you know, effectively they are demanding and nothing will satisfy them short of an exorcism.
Yes.
Well, in that case, then I will act as a bridge between them and one of the appropriate religion's deliverance ministers.
That you know.
And they will have their own processes. They will have, you know, they have psychologists and psychiatrists and medical practitioners, all of which, you know, if you go to the Catholic Church and say, hey, I want an exorcism, after the problem they had with the German exorcism of Annelise
Michel,
I can't remember. Annelise Michel.
Yeah, Annelise Michel.
They are now, you know, they will do an exorcism eventually if they decide it's passed all of their criteria. And they are the people who should do it.
Well, I don't know if you know Dr. Gallagher, Richard Gallagher. I've got a lot of respect for Dr. Gallagher. He's a psychiatrist and he's written a number of books. He's head of psychiatry for New York. He's a friend, he's a colleague, well, a friend of mine. And he is very much of a very scientific opinion. And he goes through, you know, he's connected with the Catholic Church and he's been involved in a number of exorcisms. But of course, to get to that point, as you rightfully said, Steve, it has to go through a lot of red tape.
It's a very long process.
Massively.
You know, they don't just rock up. Yeah, they don't just rock up and start throwing water around and, you know, prayers. But the Catholic Church will carry out.
I'm going to bring on another subject because what you are particularly an expert on, and is something that I wholeheartedly accept as well, because we talk about the paranormal teams going in, you know, people who are seeing orbs and they come out with all the gadgets and everything else that's there. You make it very clear in your books, you've got guidance for, you know, and you've got guidance notes for investigators, and then you've got the other book on equipment that's from the SPR, that there is no equipment out there. So whether it's an orb or anything else here, there's no equipment out there that can actually measure or detect ghosts.
If only there was the holy grail for investigators, something, you know, think back to the digital camera, you know, when it was producing these balls, these blobs of light. It was like, oh my God, perhaps we do have that holy grail piece of equipment. Yeah. But no. And, you know, people have been using the first SPR investigation, or the first investigation that's documented using equipment, is 1898 or 1899, and that's B House. And the investigators who, you know, people can look up the story for themselves, but they decided that there was some noise phenomena, which they thought may have been attributable to seismic activity, was one of the ideas they were exploring. Mm. They wanted to make a return visit with a phonograph to record the sound. and also Seismograph to test the idea of, and I think that's one of the very first documented intentions of using equipment. Unfortunately, there was a legal situation developed and they never were able to return. But if you look at the, well, I think the first screen portrayal is probably Ghostbusters,
yeah,
and the gadgets that they were using in the movie.
Well, that created an industry.
And then, of course, you know, yeah, you know, we've all got a PKE meter somewhere. But if you also look at the movie Poltergeist,
yeah,
you know, that's that fantastic scene where the army of spirits come down the stairs and the camera pans down and follows them down the stairs. What it's doing is locking this idea that equipment and technology is a route into understanding the phenomena. In reality, we don't have a single piece of equipment. We're 120 something years on from that Bee House investigation. Yeah. And there is still not a single solitary piece of equipment that can prove or disprove the existence of ghosts, spirits, poltergeists, the Loch Ness Monster or Yetis. But what we can do with the equipment, so, you know, should we not bother with equipment? Well, of course we need equipment because it allows us to objectify subjective experiences.
Yes.
If somebody says the temperature suddenly went colder,
you can verify sound. With, yes. Yeah.
We can objectify it and say, if the recorder records it, then it was a real phenomena. If the temperature really did change as opposed to a subjective perception of change, you know, people are fairly bad at reporting the temperature, you know, and they use really flowery language like it. The room was so cold, it was like walking into a refrigerator. Well, the only refrigerator I walked into, I broke my nose. But what they're trying to say really is, you know, they're trying to convey the nature of the experience, that the room did suddenly become much colder. Now, is that just a response of the nervous system, the fight and flight system, or is it an objective reality? Did the temperature really change? Well, we can objectify that. We can make measurements that will give us definitive answers. Did the temperature change? Was a real sound made? You know, did a door close somewhere? Did a door open somewhere? And that's what equipment is incredibly good at doing. Plus, the other advantage, of course, is equipment doesn't have any imagination. It has no bias. It has no expectation. Yes. It has no prior, you know, sort of desire. And so if it records and captures something, then you have something. And, of course, you can then take it away.
Yeah.
And equipment also allows you to do things that the human investigator simply can't do, because we're rubbish at staying awake for very long.
Yes,
that's true. And so if you want look at something over a course of days, weeks, or months, then the equipment, you know, you can do that now with the modern equipment. You can record, you know, almost indefinitely sound and pictures, temperature, humidity, all manner of different environmental parameters. So the equipment is incredibly useful. And I've started to say, well, it can't tell you what a ghost is, but we can tell you what it isn't.
Yes. Do you think that the media, and I've spoken to Lloyd about this a number of times as well, that the media has caused more of a problem in these shows than is necessary, because now we have so many people believing in equipment and believing that they can pick up a phenomena and attributing that to a spirit phenomena and teaching that this is the right thing. Is it ignorance, or is it? Can we put the blame solely on the media and the shows?
It's not ignorance; it's gullibility. Mm-hmm. And also, there is if you look at the items of equipment, you know, there's product placement going on. You know, somebody will build something on their kitchen table, or and they will give it to one of the TV stars to use on the show. And then you two can, well, they got these great, you know, results from using it. Where can we get one? Well, here's how you can get one, and it's only $850.
Yeah.
As seen on, and there is this, there is a weird effect that takes place. When I was in New England, I was in the fortunate position to be given use and access to the SLS camera, the exact SLS camera that was used by Zach on Ghost Adventures.
Okay.
And I'd had, you know, another model, so I knew what we were dealing with.
Yeah.
That this is using quite simple software derived from the Kinect camera, the Kinect video gaming system, which is a very simplistic 3D modeling system. It uses a number of sensors to detect a game player. And what it's really looking for, because the lines of coding are quite small, what it's looking for are certain things within the frame. And then when it recognizes these things, it sticks a little stick figure on.
Yes.
Now, one of the things it's looking for is a vertical, what's called a terminator, which we would say is a head, and then a cross sort of thing. Now, if you get an SLS camera, doesn't matter which one, but if you get an SLS camera and you aim it at the corner of a door frame, so you've got the upright of the door,
yeah,
you've got the cross piece of the, mm-hmm, and if there is, you know, the camera will almost invariably, when it sees this group of objects, its software will go, there's a person there, and it will pop a little stick man up as a visual, you know, indicator that it thinks there's a game player there. So we took this group of people out into a haunted location in New England with the Ghost Adventures SLS camera, and we had them making stick figures. You know, if you point it there, we were showing how to do it, and they were making their own little stick figure ghosts. Wherever we said, you know, we pointed to, all right, do it in the corner of that door. Oh, there's a stick figure ghost.
Yes.
Well, is it? No, well, there's no ghost, but it's looking
for it. It's looking
now, like, do it on the back of, you know. So we had all of the people making stick figure ghosts with an SLS camera. And we thought, well, that's given them food for thought. You know, we've now undermined the SLS camera, the structured light sensor camera. Until we went back for a coffee break, when a couple of the people came up and said, that was fascinating, and I've really learned a lot. But, it, you know, when Zach gets them on the program, and it's like, you know, and they're, it's like you've done nothing to undermine people's belief at all.
That's the problem we have. Is
and we had this.
If they believe in it, they're not going to budge.
We had this. Myself, for a number of years, we used to run like a training camp called So You Want to Be a Ghost Hunter. And it was a parapsychologist and myself. And we would take people through a mixture of theory, interactivity, and then on a mentored ghost hunt. And we would give them all of the, you know, the rational science explanations and the why it happens and mm-hmm. what causes that. And we'd done this all day. We were up in Edinburgh, and they were off on their mentored ghost hunt. And there was some excitement, and then somebody came running over, saying, you've got to come and see, you've got to come and see this. We've got a spirit communicating with us. And I'm like, okay, then. So awesome. We immediately hastened down there. And they pointed to, they had a video camera on a tripod, and they said whenever they asked a question, there was a red flickering light that was flickering in response to their questions.
Okay.
So we took a closer look at it. And on the back of the camera was a small red LED that flickered when the camera was writing to its solid state memory. It was the memory access light. So they would ask a question, and then they would intently watch this red light, and after a few seconds, it would record, and then it would flicker the light, and see, it responded, can you do it again? Are you the murdered victim? Look, it's flashing, and...
But of course, the red light can't identify whether it's yes or no.
It couldn't, but they did.
I was going to say.
Because what happens is, and rather like with the Maglite experiment, the Maglite torch flickering experiment, what happens is, if you watch it for long enough, you see that in actual fact, because there is a kind of pattern, the computer will, or the camera will write to the memory once every X seconds, or the way with the Maglite, the time is, after a while, becomes fairly constant and predictable because it's based upon the expansion and contraction of metal in one of the springs. But the person will start to tailor the speed at which, or the gaps in between the questions, so that it will be fairly scattergun and random at the start, but they gradually use the stimulus of the light or whatever they're working, and they slow down the rate of the questions, or they, you know, they leave a pause for the spirit to answer. But what they're really doing, the light has trained them.
Yes, okay.
It's you actually see it, you know, if you're boring and stand there watching, you know, you'll see this effect as they change their response to the stimulus.
So they're bringing it upon themselves. They're actually making it fit in any way they can.
Yeah. They are tailoring, rather than it reacting to them, they are reacting to it. And so you get this, you know, by the end of maybe 5, 10 minutes, you get quite a correlation starting to develop. See, every time I ask a question, the light flickers.
Yeah.
Well, it does now, but it wasn't 5 minutes ago, was it? It was fairly random. Yeah, well, the spirit's got to learn how to use the equipment. Right.
Before we finish off, because we're coming up then, I want to ask you something, because obviously you're finding probably a 90% or 99% of everything that you've done, you've been able to correlate a natural explanation to it, and you help people to understand that. But have you ever been in your career, have you ever experienced phenomena where you're like, okay, well, wait a minute, I don't have a natural explanation for that?
And if people think for 1 minute that I'm, you know, a hard-nosed, cynical skeptic,
you're not.
because I'm not, because you cannot spend the length of time that I've spent in some notable haunted locations where, I don't know if we're allowed to swear, but weird shit happens.
You can swear, Steve.
And despite, I was going to say weird shit happens.
Yeah.
And it's... I can count on the fingers of one hand the number of times in the past 50 years that that's happened to me. But that, I think, is, I find that reassuring that it is so infrequent.
Yeah.
Not as a sort of, not to massage my ego to say, oh, you know, you can poo-poo the rest. But what we're dealing with is something that is, almost by definition, rare. But when it happens, boy, do you know.
People make it think that it's so normal that it's there. I mean, I remember, I think, chatting to Lloyd, who, you know, I have a great respect for Lloyd Auerbach. But, you know, one of the things that we had mentioned, or I think I actually might have been taking one of his classes on Rhine, and that we always expect phenomena to happen at night when it's quiet, but it can happen during, and that, you know, it doesn't have to be that. It has to be during the day or anything. What is the biggest thing for you, Steve? What's the big thing that you're waiting on? What would make your career just the golden egg?
Another crack at the Enfield case or something similar.
Oh God, that's another episode.
because I think there are lots of memorable occasions where an explanation, you go, yeah, I'd love to, that's brilliant, or very occasionally you are left completely mind blown by what's just happened.
Yes.
But there are some landmark cases that I think I'm now in a position where I would like to tackle something as big as Enfield.
Wow.
The trouble is, I don't believe that would ever happen because we now live in a world where there are, in the UK, there's a little over 1,000 paranormal teams. Mm-hmm. And whereas in the past, they would go to the Society for Psychical Research or one of the other key organizations. Yes. Now, you know, it just gets trampled underfoot by well-intentioned amateur investigators. And I want to end this segment, if I may, by saying that in many fields of science, archaeology, astronomy, and others, some of the greatest discoveries have always been made by well-intentioned amateurs. And I think, genuinely believe that paranormal investigators are in the right place at the right time with the right sort of equipment and could produce genuinely challenging, that could then go to some of these skeptical parapsychologists and say, look, stick that in your pipe and smoke it. Give me an answer. The problem is the investigators themselves need to seriously up the game and the quality of the data that they're gathering.
Absolutely.
Because that's why they're not being taken seriously. And I hope my contribution in writing the guidance notes and ghostology and what I do by way of hopefully educating is to say, please go off and investigate haunted houses, but just take a little more care, be a little more thorough, be a little bit more critical. And you will find, you will be able to take your data and make a psychologist's life a misery. It's a plea. Go ghost hunting. Take your gadgets and your pieces of equipment, but use them critically and in a considered way. And you will eventually get that piece of evidence that you can take to Chris French, Richard Wiseman, one of the other skeptics, and say, stick that in your pipe and smoke it. Give me an answer to that one.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant. Actually, it reminds me of
a... guys. That's my aim, to try to get the paranormal community to say, you're there. You're in the haunted buildings. You're in the right place. You're at the right time. You've got the right equipment. Stop messing about.
Now, Steve, do you have, if I'm right, you've got a course, I don't know if you're still running it, but you've got a course that you teach people as well?
It's called Ghostology, and the next one is in the Republic of Ireland in September. The details are somewhere on, it's Spook Troop Tours. Check it out on Facebook.
Absolutely. Well, you can send me the links. Well, Steve, I want to thank you for being on and for joining me. I hope this is not the last time.
I've thoroughly enjoyed it, and there are many topics yet to even, we've only scratched the surface.
You'll be back on. In fact, actually, I was talking to Lloyd yesterday, and Lloyd and I were talking about we're going to definitely get you on this round table. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll have a round table coming up with a number of experts where we'll be taking a subject matter and looking at it from a belief point of view, from a bias point of view, from a scientific point of view, and all other angles so that we can really get good education out there. If you are a person who's interested in parapsychology, not in your ghost hunt in any way, then connect with Steve, follow Steve's work, get the book, join the SPR. The guidance notes for investigators is awesome. If anybody's interested in setting up their own team, then really start with that book. And if, there'll be notes in the show notes. If you're watching this on YouTube, then down in the link, you'll have details to any Steve's education courses and books. He's written a number of books as well. This is not the last time you'll hear from it. And also,
can I give one final plug?
Go for it. Plug away.
coming soon to the SPR's website, and you don't have to be a member, are what are called quick guides. So if you want the very basic, boiled down essentials of equipment, techniques, methods, these quick guides will be available within the next few weeks on the SPR's website, absolutely free of charge. Download the PDFs, print them out.
So, guys, you will get a link to that in our magazine as well, in Paranormal Daily News. We will actually promote those guides for the SPR. And if you are interested and you want to join the SPR, we'll get a link in the show notes as well, a link to anything that Steve is doing. Ladies and gentlemen, from my point of view, I am a medium. I've worked over 2 decades in this field, and I used to be the guy that believed in orbs and believed in every bit of phenomena. But if you really want to be professional, if you really want to make a difference, then learn the science, develop your spirit, and learn and balance everything out, and always look for explanations, and do not just accept anything as real, as true, and as what everybody thinks is out there. I am delighted to have Steve on. This will not be the last. I thoroughly enjoyed this. I've learned loads. And I will link also that paper to the orb phenomena, or to his orb paper. If you've got any questions, you want to ask Steve anything, then send it into the magazine, paranormaldailynews.com, and we will put that towards him. We'll ask him those questions. And educate yourself, guys. Remember that you've got a responsibility out there. And if someone's asking you to go to a potential haunted home and it's not just a place, remember that families are there and they're suffering. And don't just go in all guns blazing and looking for demons, looking for ghosts, and using every tool that you can imagine. You can leave a trail of destruction. This is Jock. This is Deadly Departed and Paranormal Daily News. Steve, final words before we finish, my friend.
Just up your game and have a good time investigating this fantastic human experience.
Brilliant. Thank you, Steve.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Hi there, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much. If you have purchased Deadly Departed, it means a lot to me. Thank you from the bottom of my heart for supporting my work. And if you haven't bought Deadly Departed yet, then consider buying Deadly Departed. You can get it on Amazon, or you can get it in any bookstore, and you can show proof of purchase and join my closed group. You can also reach out to me on Instagram at any time, at Spiritual Medium, if you have a question, and I will answer it. Have a wonderful day, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you once again. God bless.
You've been listening to Deadly Departed with renowned evidential medium and author Jock Brocas.
Jock Brocas.
If you like what you've heard, make sure to pick up a copy of the Deadly Departed book. Don't forget to share the episodes and send in your questions to us about anything paranormal and the afterlife. Tune in next time to Deadly Departed, the do's, don'ts, and dangers of afterlife communication.